is Peter Fisher, and this is the Fisher Files podcast. This is Sequence 2, Episode 6, and tonight we'll be talking about getting a junior faculty position and what to do with one once you've got one.
Because I can't be around you and not be with you if you refuse to come with me. I'll go it alone.
So far we've talked about writing your thesis and getting a postdoctoral position, and after some period of time as a postdoc, you want to move on and look for and hopefully get a position as an assistant professor somewhere, really in the most visceral sense, I guess, begin your academic life. Now, if you ask a lot of graduate students and postdocs, this is really the most common sort of ultimate goal, at least in particle physics. And you should really begin this by really asking yourself very seriously if this is really what you want to do. And this is really different from getting your first postdoc job or going to graduate school, because there is kind of an emotional commitment to being an assistant professor that there isn't to the earlier stages in your career. And there are really kind of two reasons for this, at least in my mind. First of all, in starting a junior faculty position, what you know at some point is that there is going to be a very clear evaluation of your work and determination or not of whether you get tenure. And, you know, tenure is a permanent position, and it implies a large degree in latitude. And some places it's very difficult to get, other places it's very easy. But regardless of the probability of success, it's really a very emotional undertaking and not something you want to think about lightly. The other thing that contrasts this with postdoc position is that as a postdoc, you are really hired to work on a specific project or in a specific area, and your connection with, you know, the broader university and scientific disciplines is not really part of the job description. It's nice, and it's something you should certainly do if you're so inclined, but the contrast really is that if you assume an assistant professor position, you're really taking a place within a university and all that that implies. And it really means that you're shifting your focus quite a bit from only doing research, which you do as a postdoctoral research associate, to really being a member of an academic community in which research is certainly a very important element, but certainly not the only one, and certainly not the most difficult one in some sense, because being a faculty member is really about running a university, educating students, working with your colleagues to solve problems. And the people I've seen really get into serious trouble are people who don't understand that and think that just believe in the primacy of their research. And so the emotional commitment really is that you're going to get to know a lot of people and invest quite heavily. And that's not something you want to enter into lightly. So this is the time that you really want to give some thought to whether or not you want to pursue an academic career. As a postdoc, you can easily do 3 or 6 years as a postdoc, and then quite easily, I'm told, switch to a job in industry or government or a staff position at a lab. that's gets more difficult as you get older, and the entanglement is greater when you have a position at the university. That said, assuming that you do want to have a university position, the question is, you know, how best to first position yourself to get one, and second, to actually get one. In terms of positioning, the first thing everyone looks at is what are your achievements? What scientific results really are associated with you, and what is their importance? And that's really a very large part of the basis of the evaluation. So, as I mentioned when talking about looking for a postdoctoral position, you really want to be in a position to have some important result that people are aware of. And that's kind of the main thing, but not the only thing. Another thing that's evaluated quite heavily is what role have you had in your endeavor? Are you seen as really a leader in that, in producing scientific results? Have you supervised students? Have you worked with a number of colleagues? If it's a large experiment, have you been a working group coordinator? Have you had a responsible position in the operation of the experiment? All of these things are very important to university, because most universities do not hire junior faculty just to do a job on an experiment. They really expect junior faculty to have their own research program that they are responsible for and that they run. So anything that you can do along those lines is important, and they should be things that you naturally want to do anyway. If you're really not interested in doing any of the things I just mentioned, then an academic career really may not be for you. So those are kind of the two main things. Now, in high-energy physics, the publication record is sort of problematic because the experiments are so large. But, single author or papers with a couple of other people are really valuable in setting you aside from the crowd. And certainly in other fields, like astronomy, condensed matter physics, and so on, that do not have large teams, they are essential. So it's very important that not only do you have a record of achievement, but that these things be published and in refereed journals. So those are kind of the things you want to have in play. Now, another thing that's important is a really strong research direction. Now, this is a little bit difficult, particularly these days, especially in high-energy physics, when there are only a few experiments around and you're not really, don't have a lot to choose from. But that said, you want to have clear in your mind what it really is you want to do. And that doesn't mean that this is fixed, but it does mean that if you see an ad for University XYZ and respond to it and get to the next stage of being interviewed, you want to think carefully whether your research interests really match their research interests. Now, I have certainly seen no shortage of applicants who are very flexible about their interests and basically just want a faculty position and don't care what they're doing. That's really not going to work. You have to, in your research statement or cover letter, really express what it is that you want to do in a very clear manner, and explain why it's important, and explain why it's good for that university to have that. So those are kind of the three major things, some achievement, demonstration of leadership, and a clear research direction. Now, most unlike postdocs, most universities follow kind of a similar hiring pattern, although there are certainly many, many exceptions to this. And that is, the search committee kind of gets together in the fall, and there is an ad, and applications come in through fall term, and the search committee will get together and make up a short list sometime in, say, December or November, and then bring people through for interviews in the sort of December through, say, February time frame. And then in the middle of winter term, say in February or January or so, we'll get together and decide who to make offers to. And then offers will be made in mid-spring, say sometime in spring. And so in your planning, you really want to be thinking that you want to be in a position to make a strong application in fall. So this kind of, as much as you can, tailors when you want results to come out and when you want to be, you know, at your maximum visibility. So it's important to use contacts and talk to your thesis supervisor and other people, that other senior people that you know, about who's looking and certainly about the quality of various places, because again, unlike postdocs, you're going to rely much more on your fellow faculty members. Keep in mind that certainly in high energy physics, it's typical for a postdoc to be based at the experiment rather than at the university. So you will be living at the university with your faculty colleagues, and so any insight you can get about them at a potential place is valuable. So your application should certainly contain a CV and a publication list. Now, even if you're a student on an experiment like Babar, you might have a few hundred publications. So you should take pains to select, say, five of them and put those separately on your CV as primary publications, or, you know, identify them as publications that are really due to you. And this is a place where single author papers and review articles are particularly valuable. So you want those things. If you have a particularly interesting preprint, you should certainly send it along. And there are two ways of approaching the cover letter. You can either have a cover letter that describes what your research interests are and why it fits with the place you're writing to, or you can have a very short cover letter and a research statement that you simply attach. Now, when I did this, I actually put my research interests in the cover letter because I changed it for every place that I was applying and tailored it specifically to the place. And I would actually suggest that because, you know, one of the first questions a search committee asks when they're going through a big pile of applications is this person really interested in coming here, or are they just trying to get a faculty job somewhere and they don't really care where it is? So tailored, personally written cover letter is very valuable. So as always, it's better to get these things in earlier rather than late, and you should contact your recommenders, typically three, and have them send letters. This is a case where it pays to read the fine print, because many universities, including MIT, requires that one of the letters be from the candidate's PhD advisor. I don't quite know why this is, but you just want to be sure that if that's required, that you're doing that. In choosing recommenders, the thing not to do is to send them a one-line email message saying, "I'm applying at University XYZ, can you send me a letter?" question mark, and then hit return and assume it's done. The letters are very important. It should be, you want good letters, obviously, and the letters should demonstrate a really clear knowledge of what you've been doing. In terms of who to ask, certainly it helps if the letters come from senior people in your collaboration or very well-known people in your field. However, there's a big caveat to this. Certain people are just notorious for writing effusive letters for anyone who asks, and this, in fact, hurts a little bit. So it's worth checking out who is a good person to ask. Now, when you ask someone to write a letter, in general, if they say, well, they're too busy, I'm too busy, or, you know, I really haven't kept track of what you're doing, you know, maybe there's somebody who's a little bit more aware of your work. If you hear something like that, if you hear any, you know, reluctance, find someone else, because those are the kind of things that get said when somebody just feels they can't write you a very good letter. And a not very good letter is a not very good letter, even if it comes from a Nobel Prize winner. So you want people who are knowledgeable about what you've done and who can write a good letter. Now, when I say good letter, I'm not just saying a letter that is favorable to your candidacy. I'm saying the kind of letter that a search committee can actually get some information out of. So this is kind of the features of a good letter. It doesn't have to be long, but a good letter should have an introductory paragraph explaining the letter writer's relationship with the candidate. There should be a few paragraphs describing what the candidate has done at some level of detail, and there should be a few paragraphs assessing the characteristics and suitability of the candidate. Good, thoughtful letters are really important, and so it's really worth talking to people and finding out who that you can ask is really able to write you a good letter. Not, as I said, a good letter that's useful to the committee. If you're searching for, you know, a number of jobs, I mean, if you're responding to a number of ads, or just in general, it's a good idea to politely ask to meet with the person, explain what you're doing, you know, how many positions you're looking at, how many letters you're asking them to write. You want to do this well in advance of any deadline. And it might be helpful to prepare a one-page summary of what you have done to help them. You know, letter writing is just a gigantic pain in the ass. And all of us who have to do it with because we have a real sense of duty and seriousness about the process. And so anything that the candidate does to help, I think, goes right to the bottom line. So if you prepare an honest one-page list of your accomplishments and hand it to the person, that will help quite a bit. And so I very strongly urge you to do that. I also would simply have the letters sent. Don't wait for the search committee to contact you. In general, search committees that I chair or that I'm on, we just assume that when we get an application, three letters are going to be showing up. We don't solicit the letters ourselves, and it's only with great reluctance that we remind candidates to get their letter writers to send things in. So get ahead of the curve and take care of this yourself. This is a time when it's important to be well ahead of the deadline. So that's the basic thing that you want. Now, it's completely appropriate, and if there's any recommended any ambiguity recommended, that you phone up someone on the search committee and just ask them about the position. There's nothing wrong with doing this. People I've talked to have been very afraid to do this, but far from wasting someone's time, it can save everybody a valuable time. I mean, it could be that the position is really targeted at something that you're not interested in, but because of university regulations, it has to be advertised as an open position. It could be that they may not have a position that year, and that they're just really hoping somebody incredible shows up. There's a lot of things that you can get from just a simple phone call. Now, you can also get misled by a simple phone call. Search committees do not have a unanimous opinion about what they are doing. And it could be that you get a guy who is kind of on the other side of the team from where you want to be, and discourages you from applying because they don't want to support your area rather than the search committee. You can generally pick that up over the phone, and it's not bad to phone one or two people on the search committee. But the bottom line, the real message here is don't worry about phoning someone up and asking them. Another valuable thing to know is the time scales for decisions. So anyway, assuming you've done a good job with the application, you're going to get invited to come and give a talk, referred to as the job talk, and maybe you gave one as a postdoc. This is a lot different than the job talk you gave as a postdoc. Postdocs just have to show that they can do something and, kind of get up on their hind legs for an hour and talk about it. Remember, the search committee is really looking at you as a colleague, not as a subordinate. And so your job talk should not be chock-a-block full of technical detail about how clever you are. Your job talk should clearly describe the result, clearly explain why it's important, and clearly explain your role in it. And I would say that's probably about two-thirds of the talk. And then it should segue into a talk about, a technical talk about the research you want to do if you're successful in getting this position. And again, the clearer it is, the more concise it is, the better. Remember, for most places, even for a big place like MIT, bringing in a junior faculty member is a huge, huge financial commitment. And one thing that's lurking in the back of all of these guys' minds is, does this guy know what to do with the resources that we would give him were he to come here? Or she? Does this person really know what they're doing? And that's what the second third of your job talk should really be about. The last third of the job talk is something to convince them that you have some clue about where you're going and what you're doing. As with any talk, it is very important that the job talk be the allotted length, usually an hour, and that there be plenty of time for questions. So most people can give pretty decent job talks. The other thing that you should do with your job talk is make it interesting. Don't make it one of these things where you, in a bored tone of voice, describe the detector and then drill down through the results. Make it interesting. Get people's opinion. The other thing you should do is, when you're contacted about an interview, make sure you understand what the intended audience is. Is the chair of the department, who's maybe not in your field, going to be there? Is it just the search committee? Is it a seminar? Make sure you understand who's going to be in the audience and what the right level is. Now, the other thing about being interviewed is that when you show up, you will get a schedule of who you talk to. And it is very possible that in one day you will talk to 8 different people and have to give a one-hour seminar and then go and have dinner the next night. Or this might be split over a couple of days, but you're going to be expected to talk to order 8 people, possibly many of them outside of your field. at smaller universities, the search committee might only have one person from high energy physics, and other people from the field. And you want to know that, and you want to prepare. You want to have answers to questions like, why are you coming to University XYZ? Where else are you looking? Why do you think your research fits in here? How do you anticipate dividing your time between the university and the laboratory? What level of startup funds would you need? You know, think through all the different questions that could come up in any one of these 8 interviews. Do not be passive in the interview. Remember, it's an exchange, and you want to be very, very sure that you get a clear picture of the place and what you're expected to do. And so it's really important that you ask questions during the interview too. Don't just sit there and respond to questions about what you're doing. So that it's really important that you get a clear picture. One thing, when I do this, as head of the division, I always meet with the candidates first. The first thing I explain is the hiring process, and this is to, you know, give them some idea of, you know, when they can expect us to get back to them, and some idea of, you know, the nature of the position, meaning how likely is it that we're able to hire in our area. The second thing I explain, and I explain this very carefully, is our tenure process and the time scales involved and what's expected. And if this is not explained to you, you should ask. You should really be clear, and there's nothing wrong with this. It's a very, very important thing for you to know. And if in asking this you get any kind of uneasy feeling, that's very important to know also. The other thing about the interviews is it absolutely never hurts to ask someone about their research, and people generally look kindly on this, so be sure to think about that as well. So if things are going well, and it looks like you're going to get the position, you should really have a very clear idea of what kind of startup package you're going to need. And there are a lot of things to think about here. Obviously, there's just research support for the getting started, and relocation expenses. But don't just think in terms of money. Think in terms of what your teaching load's going to be like. How many terms off can you get? Can you negotiate for something like lighter teaching duty? Things like that. And how many advisees you will have, what your committee responsibilities will be. This is a time to really go through all of that stuff with whoever you're talking with, usually the department chairman, and work those things out. And this will also be your first indication of, you know, how seriously they are about your area. Now, this is a place where it's really critical to talk to peers in the field and find out what startup packages in your particular field are like. You want to ask for something reasonable, but you want to be sure that you get enough to be able to do whatever it is you want to do. So you really have to kind of know in some sense what the going rate is. It's not going to be good if you kind of go in asking for $3 million and they're coming in thinking $100K. So do some homework and find out what really is reasonable. There are some other things that you can just bluntly discuss. I believe there's for example, a limit to the number of Sloan applications or Sloan nominations each university can make. I think a university cannot make any more than 3, or maybe department can't make any more than 3. I don't know, but this is an important source of early funds, and you want to know that the department will nominate you, perhaps several times if necessary. So you want to be sure that there isn't, you know, four people ahead of you, and bluntly asking is completely okay. About the negotiating, it's important to develop a sense of when is time to start finalizing the deal or the non-deal, whichever it is. Don't let it drag on too long. Usually two or three iterations, and you should be there. If it's a lot more than that, then something ain't right. And clearly, if you're not going to be given the resources you need to do your research, it's not a position you should think about. So try to keep the negotiation moving ahead. And this is really kind of your best way to assess the environment you're going to be going into. Once you've shown up, it's very important when you're starting not to undertake too much. Usually, you're going through a whole lot of transitions at one time. You're moving your family. You're starting a new position. You could be making a very, very substantial change in your research direction. And this is not the time to agree to write a big review article or get involved in some, you know, wacky marginal project. There's plenty of time for that later. What you really want to do is concentrate on getting, you know, whatever your core research is going. And another very important thing that you do when you're first there is recruiting students. And I will tell you that, you know, getting good students early, you know, one or two good graduate students early is absolutely key. So you're showing up in fall, the new graduate students are showing up in fall. It's very, very important to really try to recruit the best ones. So one thing that you can do is, once you've accepted the position, is immediately ask for a list of the students who are coming in the fall and write each one of them a personal letter. This is a time when something on actual paper might be more appropriate than an email. Introduce yourself, explain what you're doing, and ask them to come see you when they're in the process of this, trying to decide what groups to work with. Now, a lot of universities do it different ways. Some places have rotation systems. But your main task in that first term is to get one or two really good graduate students. So really concentrate on that. The other thing you're going to be doing is meeting your colleagues. And, you know, these are people potentially that you're going to spend your life with. And you're going to go to their funerals and their weddings and know their kids and be very involved in their lives in a way that you aren't in a laboratory setting, or in general aren't. So you'll probably get, you know, invitations for dinner and things like that. And you should take them, if at all possible. You know, how you conduct yourself in kind of the early part of your time as a new professor is important. Not that you're being assessed or judged or anything like that, but it's important for you to feel like you've gotten off to a good start and really made contact with people. I look at it in terms of investing. You're, wherever you are, you're going to be investing in that place. And you may be continuing to work on an experiment at Fermilab, for example, but your investment is going to be made at your university, and you should be very clear about that. If you don't feel like investing in your university and instead spend your time at whatever lab you're working at and cultivating relationships there, you're really making a mistake with your career, because ultimately it will always come back to your university. So get started on that and build some healthy habits. It's probably not a bad idea to ask to give a seminar early on or a colloquium to kind of introduce yourself. It's also a good way to teach, to contact the incoming graduate students. As far as the research, you know what to do with that, and the main thing is just don't undertake too much. So that's kind of what I have to say about junior faculty positions. Really the big summary advice I have from this podcast is really make sure it's something that you want. Think it through and talk to people, because it's in many ways it's a very tough time, and it's not something that's for everybody. And you know, real wisdom is being able to know to avoid something like that, no matter how much you've been trained to want. I just briefly wanted to mention a couple articles in the most recent Nature. One is about graphene paper. This is it's also called Bucky paper. It's sort of this carbon nanotube type stuff, except the nanotubes are unrolled. And this paper has, you know, incredibly high strength and some very interesting mechanical properties. And it's made by self-assembly, so I guess you spark this graphite arc and you wind up with kind of this little bath full of micron-sized little sheets, and then by differential flow assembly you can build it up into actually a fairly thick paper-like substance that I think is stronger than any other, you know, paper-like substance, and has very good insulating properties. And this article reports the first creation of this stuff, and also has done some studies indicating that the different layers are held together by kind of a monolayer of water, or perhaps oxygen. It wasn't really clear from the article. So this is, really kind of a new stuff and an emerging technology. And the self-assembly is very interesting. It's like the carbon nanotube wires that you just arrange flow patterns, so it's advantageous to build a wire. And these little things will just make a wire for you. And in this case, this little thing will make a sheet. The other article, which is that I found interesting, which is actually the next article in the journal, is about changes in precipitation. So in the middle, northern, and southern latitudes, this paper shows for the first time a correlation between anthropic activity, human activity, and increased rainfall. And so this now joins a long list of anthropic changes to the weather. And the methodology is interesting. It's comparing 100 years worth of rainfall records with about 50 different computer models, and every one of them shows that the observed increase in rainfall is definitely predicted on average by all of these different models. So that's, I think this is kind of an important paper. And you should have a look at it. so that's it for this week. One thing I want to report is I had a very nice conversation with John Marston about the audio quality, which he describes as atrocious. He says content's great, audio quality's atrocious. So on Monday I'm going to ask Sheila to order a nice Marantz digital recorder with, you know, professional studio microphones. And we'll set that up, and we'll make a little studio somewhere, a studio that others of you can use. So one thing I'm thinking about for Sequence 3 is I'd really like to get some other people involved. I'd really like other people to sit down and talk about what they think, or talk to with me about what they think. So I'm actually ordering two microphones. And we kind of have this really nice thing that this podcast is distributed through iTunes, so it's very easy for people to get. And we have a website that we're going to hire someone to set up, so that if anyone out there has something to say and wants to do two or three podcasts or 10 podcasts or however many, I have this whole system for hosting it. So ideas are welcome. The other thing I'm going to be changing is John mentioned that the format I use, which is M4A, is a little bit difficult for a lot of people. So from now on I'm going to convert everything to MP3, which will probably make the files longer and the quality lower, but will not present a barrier to people who want to listen. So that's it. As always, I'd like to thank John and Sheila and John Thompson and Maynard Galinas for Disk Space and so on, and Bonna Newman and Homer Reed from Refs. So I hope you're enjoying your summer, and keep up the good work in Cambridge or wherever you are. Kaheinoa, aina mai kapuana, kalanika vikaheinoa.